My name is Bruce Dedman. Hardly a name to go into hospital with. Nevertheless, at the age of 88 years, perhaps I can share some of my recollections with you of those early days as a native of Maldon.
So, Bruce, you were 10 when war started.
Yes.
And you've got quite a lot of lovely memories of when you were quite young, before the war.
Yes.
You were telling me. Can we start with your memories of the opening of the Maldon bus station?
That was one of the first things I can recall. We were at school in Maldon, and for some reason the school was closed. The new one had to be built. During that period, we were housed in the Reformed Church at the top of Market Hill. And when the school was finished, the Maldon Secondary School, we moved down to Mill Road. Now, shortly after moving into Mill Road School, the bus park, the new bus park, opened in Maldon. And the schools arranged for a pageant to be put on in that big space. It was one of the biggest indoor spaces in Maldon at the time. And we went there with cardboard shields and swords and enacted Boadicea fighting off the Romans, which most Essex children would know about. The cardboard effects were for safety first, and we danced around merrily to applause, and then I think the very next day the bus park opened for services.
And you told me that there was an hourly bus service to Chelmsford.
There was. That was very important to people who were now beginning to go to Chelmsford to work, and Hoffman's was one of the biggest employers in the Essex area, and I think there was an hourly bus service to Chelmsford, early in the morning taking the workers, after tea bringing them back. And it also gave a better service all round the Maldon district to the villages, Woodham Walter, Bradwell, Tollesbury.
And there was a very important service on Saturday evening, I believe?
Now, Saturday evening, I believe the name of the man was Dines from Woodham Walter, who I think had some sort of a garage up there, but certainly an old bus, and it was an old one. And these used to come into Maldon and park down near the Warwick pub that's still there today. And Saturday nights, it left. It was the last contact with Woodham Walter. And when it left, he'd collected a number of orders for fish and chips, and these were all bundled in, wrapped up, and put aboard the bus. And I assume that when he got to Woodham Walter, he delivered them round. And it would be done for an extra fee, no doubt. But it was a service that Woodham Walter must have enjoyed, because there was no other way at 8 o'clock at night around this district then, that everything closed down. You couldn't get anything.
That was a very welcome bus service then, wasn't it?
I think so.
Can we move on, Bruce? You mentioned to me about the county show that was held.
Yes, I recall the one and only county show in memory, and I would have been about possibly 9 years old. It was down the end of what we know as Park Drive today, right at the bottom. And there was a vast acreage of common ground. I don't know if anyone ever claimed it, but that was open to anyone who used to go round there. But over these acres, on this particular time, the Essex show settled down from all over the county. Farm animals, farm machinery, and the staff to go with it. One of the things they didn't have in those days was refrigeration. And so every night we were welcome down there with our buckets to take milk home, because they couldn't do anything with it.
Right. They're giving away free milk, leftover milk.
They had to get rid of it. They couldn't.
Of course. Yes. That was a bonus.
Well, that wasn't the time for working families.
Of course.
You know.
Of course. And Sundays. Sunday school.
Sunday school. Very likely, in reflection, I think we were sent there to get out of the way for 5 minutes from our parents. But the Sunday school that we went to from where I lived on the Lower Downs Road was the Methodist. and that is just at the bottom of the High Street. Still there today. We were given a penny for the collection. And on the way to school, we passed one sweet shop that was open. There were no other shops open in the High Street on Sundays. This one sweet shop with the white canvas blinds outside. I remember they fluttered in the breeze, and that was a sort of oasis for all hungry children. And we went in there and asked for a ha'porth of acid drops. And we got a ha'porth. You could buy a ha'porth, and they were put in a bag. And with the other ha'penny, we went to the Sunday school and put that in the collection.
So you shared your penny.
As I think I've said before, trusted that our maker would accept the compromise.
Where were you living at this time?
Lower Downs Road in Malden.
Can you explain exactly? It's the bottom of North Street?
If you go down to the bottom of the High Street and turn left into North Street, it goes right down to the river, and the Lower Downs Road is right at the bottom. There, and that was a sort of, if you like, they were tribal areas in Malden. Fitcher's Crescent was another one, alien to us. We didn't go that way, and they didn't come our way. We're all different tribal areas made up of families that knew each other.
Yeah. And you said, keeping with the subject of Sundays, you were saying that there was a fish delivery on a Sunday.
The fishermen all lived down that way. If you went down to North Street, before you got to the river, there was an open area, and you could go down to the river or turn right to go down to where the Queen's Head public house is today. All along that terrace on the right, fishermen lived, and people to do with boats. The whole area down there obviously was next to the river and for boats. But Sunday morning, a man by the name of Sexton, an elderly man, a fisherman, used to come round with a massive wicker basket, and in it he had all sorts of fish and shrimps, things you'd never see in that river today. And they were cheap, they were pennies, you know. There wasn't no money, big money, and they were bought for tea. And one of the main things that most people had Sundays was winkles from the mud in the Blackwater. And at 5 o'clock on a Sunday, you could hear everybody outside with a bucket. The winkles were put in with salt water, and they twisted the handle round, and you could hear the swish of the buckets cleaning the winkles, ready for tea. And we used to sit round the table and each given a pin each to get the winkle from the shower and have that with bread and butter. I wouldn't touch them these days, but that was a Sunday tea.
That was a Sunday treat, was it?
I don't know about treat, that was just something else that we lived on, you know. Yeah. It didn't cost much.
Yeah. That's a lovely memory. You've written, because you do a lot of creative writing, don't you?
Yes.
You're a member of a creative writing group. Mm. You've written a lovely piece here about pea pickers.
Yes.
Families that went out pea picking.
That's right.
Do you remember that yourself?
Yes. Once again, possibly 9 years old, and when the school holidays come, the holiday period was there. Many in those days worked and only got about a week's holiday, and they couldn't afford holidays, really. The working class didn't get much money. But the women and the children, in general, went to the pea fields. And we'd all collect outside of the forecourt of a pub or some prominent building in Malden, early in the morning, 7 o'clock. And there was prams and baggage and children and women, and a lorry had come along from the farm. We'd all scramble aboard, standing, no seats, and then go out to Woodham Walter or Woodham Mortimer or Purley, get out the lorry, and then walk along the edge of the field. The field foreman would come along and tell you which row of peas you've got to pick. They were either a row, or I think it was called a stetch. Some women took on two rows. Children usually took on one. Some of the women, good field workers, had been on it for years, and they could pick up a handful of rice that the peas grew on and snatch them off as quick as that. They really were quick. But as 9-year-olds, your task for the day was to stick in one row, pick the rice up, pick the peas and get one bag.
You called it rice?
Yes, that's what is. If you see peas growing in a field, what they grow on is pea rice. And you plucked it out the soil, put it like that in the bag.
Right.
You know. And the foreman kept an eye on everybody. He didn't want, if you walked past rice and didn't pick it up to keep up with your parents or someone else, back you come and had to pick that clean, you know. Right. And by dinner time, that was cheese sandwiches and a bottle of water from the spring. Most of these farms had a spring in those days, and you went and got fresh spring water. And then you had that 2 hours in the afternoon in the sun, which was real labour, because you'd got to get that bag. And some of the women by then had got 6 bags or more. They were good, you know. And come about 3 o'clock, a scale was put in the middle of the field, and the foreman told everyone to bring their bags in. The bags were weighed one at a time, and they were checked to see if you put stones in them or rice that had been picked to make up the weight, and he wouldn't have any of that. Mm. And they were weighed, tied up. The farmer gave you your money. Now, that could be 2 shillings or 2 and 6 or a little more. That depended on the size of the peas. One of the biggest peas picked was a telegraph, and that was a big pea. And of course, that was great for children because you could fill a bag in a day and you knew you was going to do it. Smaller peas took longer, and so the price wavered on what sort of pea you were picking.
And did you keep the money yourself?
Ah, in those days, you come out the pea field and you was proud that you had picked a bag of peas, but the money was to buy you boots and clothing for the next school term. That wasn't anything to go and spend.
Did you enjoy that?
Oh, yeah, because we didn't know any different. And lots of the kids knew each other in the pea field. And, yes, that was okay. But we didn't have holidays as such. We didn't go anywhere.
No. So you had a laugh while you were doing it.
Yes, and the relief at the end of the day probably was to get down the promenade and go in the Marine Lake that used to be there. You know.
Bruce, you've got a story about an air raid shelter being built, your family shelter.
Yes.
In the back garden.
Shortly after the war started, we went through a year of what was known as the phony war, and nothing much happened. But all the young men disappeared into the army, and young women too, for different various services, nursing. But left in Maldon were the veterans from the First World War. Now, one of their duties was to be in the Home Guard, or the ARP, or the Fire Service. And so they used to do a 12-hour working day, a factory at Bentalls in Heybridge, or SADS, 12-hour day, and then spend some of their evenings practising Home Guard duties, or in fact, on duty as Home Guard, down the river, anywhere where there's important military points, you know. So they weren't available to do anything. But once again, all the women that were at home at that time buckled down to sort of a war effort. And through the experiences of the First World War, I can hear my father saying, get below the level of the ground. And if you read enough about the First World War, you'll understand why they thought that. And so, without hesitation, our back garden was set upon with spades and shovels by me, my brother, a couple of other young lads, the neighbours, and we all dug a big, deep trench. And it was all black, wet earth. Now, we had to cover it over with something, and nearby were some derelict houses. And at some time or other, people had made flooring with these big enamel posters, lion's tea, all that sort of thing. Big sheets of enamel. We carted them over and put wood across the top of the trench, and then these enameled adverts on the top, and then this wet earth was heaped over the top. Now, one summer afternoon when this was getting finished, I personally had had enough of it all, and I was very hot. And I sauntered off back down to our house and found the carrots, carrots in those days were what took place of sweets. There were no sweets. Carrots were sweet vegetable. And they were sold clean and ready to eat, you know. And I found one and I wandered back and without anybody looking, dropped into the trench, went right up the far end, complete darkness, damp, cool, wet, and sat there crunching this carrot. Suddenly, the timber started to creak and the whole thing fell in. Now, being at one end, I was held by timbers and fell in and, you know, leaned on the wall. But I managed to put one arm up and wave. Everybody went mad on the surface to get me out. I remember one woman jumped over a nearby fence and grabbed a shovel. But I was quite all right at the end of the day. And when I stood up, I'd still got the carrot in my hand. So,
of course.
So it all ended well.
And did you get told off for that?
No, I don't think so. I think they were just happy that I was OK. I don't think I got told off.
Good. And you were able to finish your carrot.
Oh, yes. And I think the idea of the trench, you know, that was all pulled to bits and the garden filled in again.
What happened when war finally ended? What celebrations were there in Malden?
Well, that went on all over the place, but I can remember once again being about 15 or 16, and we were down the end of Park Drive, and that was near the council dump where they held barrels of tar and things for the roads. You didn't have machinery, you had pots on wheels and barrels of tar to mend the roads with, you know. And some people got down there. I don't know if they were soldiers that had come back from the war or younger men, but the sort of thing they'd done, they got barrels of tar and set fire to it and built a big bonfire. And then I remember one or two walking past with a coffin with Hitler's name on it and threw that on the fire. And in reflection, I think, what childish things to do, but that was what people done in those days. And that was the only way they could celebrate. They couldn't afford to be in a pub at that time.
Right.
So they had a bonfire.
And the ringing of the bell?
Ah, I was 16 years old. During my school time, I went to work part-time after school and Saturdays at the greengrocers in Malden, halfway up the high street. And when I left school, I went in there full-time. And on the day the war ended, two people marched up the high street. One was Edgar Clark, Mr. Edgar Clark, who ran a fish and chip shop more or less opposite where Bunting's the Butchers is today. And I always remember him because during the war, they had a blanket over the door, and as people went in and out, and there was a lot of them during the war because fish and chips was a food that you could get without a ration book, and he used to shout and create if anyone left the blanket ajar so light was coming out, because he'd get fined by the ARP. And the other one was a man named Boutwell, Rip Boutwell. I know his granddaughter, and I've had words with her about him. And he was a man who, over the turn of the century, was in the old Malden band, a band who had uniforms and gilt cuffs and all that. You see them in old photographs. So I knew where he come from, much like character. And these two marched up the high street. Edgar Clark had got a massive handbell that came off the county's fish and chip shop and was ringing that, and Rip Boutwell, being an ex-drummer in the band, was playing a kettle drum, and they both walked up the street. Once again, how Victorian that must have looked, but the Mr. Tyler, who I work for, oh, he said, that's because of the end of the war, he said, take no notice of it.
Wonderful, a good celebration for the end of many years of conflict.
And yet, akin to that, I remember seeing a tramp walk up the street with a rusty bicycle and some bags on it. And he picked it up and threw it down in the road and used terrific language, kicked it. And once again, Mr. Tyler said to me, take no notice. He said, that's the man shell-shocked from the First World War. And, of course, they didn't get any help then. They were left to make their own way. Mm. And he was on the verge of madness.
Mm. Mm. What was life like working at the greengrocer's? You must have been busy. Did you start very early in the morning?
Initially, going from school, and this is one thing I can't forget, he had a trade bike with a little iron basket on the front that would hold one box of something or other. And I had to go down to the bottom end of Cross Road where an elderly gentleman lived. I can't think of his name. But they were really Victorian people. His wife wore a white bonnet tied under the chin, you know. And they lived in this house that's long gone since. And behind them was a garden with apple trees. And he grew everything. And you've got to remember the war was on, so anything to sell in a greengrocer's had to be picked up wherever it could be. And I went down there with this bike. And he, nice old man. And he got this big box of plums. Now, that's a lot of weight. And that was put in this carrier on the front of the cycle. But the carrier itself could move. That was loose. Then he came out with another box of apples and put that on top. And then a bunch of flowers for Mr. Tyler's wife on top. Now, I've got to get that moving and get on that bike and keep it going.
Yeah.
And I used to do that and get up Once Road painfully, go into the high street, and by the time I was going up the high street, I was on a hill. And standing at the shop was Mr. Tyler with an arm up gesturing me to turn in now with no traffic. And as soon as I turned, every now and again, the whole thing would go over. And out come Mr. Tunbridge from the draper's shop, and he's somebody else from another shop, all helping pick up vegetables.
And then they were sold in the shop.
Oh yeah, well they only rolled down the road,
yeah.
Oh yeah. And at one time too, that happened when I just got out of this place in Crossroad and went to move away from the fence and got on the cycle, and I went over the top then, and the headmaster of the school come along, and him and me picked everything up back. But I was frightened of that bike.
Yes.
I couldn't, you know, that wasn't, the whole thing was falling to pieces. I was frightened of it.
Mm. But lovely to have fresh plums, fresh apples.
Oh, yes. And in those days, on a Saturday, Osborne's bus service from Tollesbury, red buses. And Joe Osborne, one of the brothers, used to drive one of the early buses into Malden. And he'd stop outside the shop and he'd bring out from the boot baskets of watercress, lettuce, people really? Sending all the stuff in.
Wow.
And then he'd get back on the bus and down that would go to the Warwick and turn around.
Another piece of writing that you've done, Bruce, is about a mud race, an early mud race.
Yes. This would be just before the Second World War, very likely about 8 or 9. Now, we lived right by the river, and just along the Higher Downs Road was a park, a green sward that went down to the marshes, two small swimming pools, and a park keeper's house, all given to the town by Mrs. Henrietta Sad. There used to be a plaque on the house, but I believe in recent times it's been pulled down, a new house built there. But at that time, you could go across the marsh, and that was a narrow part of the river where mud shelved down to the bottom of the river and then shelved up on the other side. At low tide, there might have been about 12 inches of water there, at a very low tide. On this particular day, about four of us who lived down there had just arrived home, and I suspect from memory that my mother was out at war work or something, I don't know. It wouldn't be war work, but she was out working somewhere, because when we got home, someone had spotted a peculiar aeroplane on the marshes the other side of the river. And without more ado, we went down to the park and down to the marsh. And in those days, it was mandatory to wear short trousers. You never wore long trousers till you left school. So all we had to do was take off boots and socks, and we were ready to slide down the mud, cross the 12 inches of water, and then up the other side. And lo and behold, on the marsh stood an Ortigaro. Now, that was an early form of helicopter. And I think the difference is, whereas a helicopter of today is the rotors are turned direct from a power, from an engine, in those days, the rotors mounted on the top of an ironwork, a lattice ironwork above the cockpit, were driven by the force of the propeller up front. It was an unusual construction and an unusual plane to ever see, and we were thrilled to stand there and see this small, unusual aircraft. The pilot obviously had gone off somewhere to get help, and we assume that it had landed on the marsh because of engine failure. Anyway, having seen it, we went back across the river and in a pool on the marsh, cleaned up, boots and socks on, and back to school. And this happened within the hour of the school break at midday.
So you obviously did that a few times.
Well, no, we only done that once, but we spent a lot of time in the mud and down the river and all that sort of thing.
So as you say, that was one of the very first mud races.
Well, it could have been.
A bit later on, after the war, you've been telling me about barges coming in and being broken up.
Yes. Now, towards the end of the war, it was becoming apparent that sailing barges had no longer got trade because motorised coasters, the railways, were all taking over the movement of freight. And barge owners weren't getting the work. And they were only too quick to get rid of the barges because they were costly to keep. And so older barges were suddenly being laid up in creeks in the rivers and waiting for someone to buy them up. At the top of the North Street, there was a house known as the Castle because it was in the old days a public house. In my time there, it was a doss house. Tramps, if you like to call them that, from all over the country came to places like that to do field work in season. Pea pickers, people who pick stones off the fields, people who pick sprouts at Christmas by hand. Everything was done by hand. And these men travelled round the country and stayed at doss houses. Pretty crude form of being looked after, but there they were. In the yard, a man by the name of Grimwade, and his nickname was Bump Grimwade. The family owned a castle and the doss house, and in the yard was a coal yard, and he sold coal to the locals and paraffin, that sort of thing, and wood. Every now and again, a barge would be pulled in to what was known as the Hard, right at the bottom of the North Street Hill. And I believe at one time these hards on the river were owned by the parishes. But the only one left when I was a child was the one right at the bottom where we lived. And I think to this day that belonged to St Mary's, but I'm not sure. The barge was pulled in there. Bum Grimwade went down there with one hand. A middle-aged man, a single man who lived near us, by the name of Dick James. And the two of them started on a barge with sledgehammers, crowbars, two-man saws, and gradually took it to pieces. All the armour was lifted off that they could lift off, and then bit by bit they took the rest. Possibly the masts weren't there, they were valuable, and they very likely would have been took down before the barge was took into that dock, you know. Every night they had a big trolley on iron wheels with massive ropes on the front, and the two of them had loaded this trolley up with massive pieces of timber and drag it up the hill to the castle yard. They did.
Yeah, where it was recycled and that, sold on.
It was sawed up and sold on.
Yeah.
And as kids, sometimes we'd help push it up there, you know.
Mm.
But they cleared the thing. They cleared every bit of that barge off of that mud.
Yeah.
And people wouldn't believe it these days.
Can you remember how long it would have taken to dismantle a whole barge?
I don't know. Some time. I mean, they didn't do it every day. It was there for some time.
Mm.
You can imagine, I should imagine 2 months at least.
At least, yeah. It's a fair bit of wood in a barge, isn't there?
Lots of wood.
Yeah. Timber, wood. We should say, yes.
Yes, yeah. But by hand.
Yes, I know.
By hand.
Incredible.
And at the same time, my brother, he'd started work at Cook's as an apprentice, and there was nothing done there by machinery at all, all by hand, baking barges.
Mm.
And they were still repairing them then, because barges went on for a few more years of life.
Mm.
But at the same time, the other end, the tail end, they were being brought in to be broke up.
Yeah. Yeah. Where did you work after the greengrocers?
After the greengrocers changed hands, and I stayed there and till I got called up at 18.
Mm.
And that was when life changed dramatically.
Quite. Yeah.
You know, suddenly where we were in Worley Barracks, couldn't go home, getting used to a new way of life.
Mm.
And that's a long story, really.
Yeah. Were you serving abroad in other countries, or were you based over here?
I went to I was at Woolley Barracks for I think 6 weeks, and then went down to North Wales to join the artillery, and we had a few weeks down there training, and then we went to Woolwich, and from there we went to Liverpool, and from there to Port Said.
Did you?
Mm. Mm. As I say, that is an eye-opener, so
yeah,
suddenly.
I'm sure. Yeah. And that was 2 years or 3 years?
2 years.
2 years.
That used to be 18 months, the conscript period, but for some reason, a crisis somewhere, they put it up to 2 years when we were there.
Mm. And after that, when you started your career, what field were you in?
Well, I don't know so much as a career, but I came out and I was sort of... I didn't think my mother liked to see me hanging about too long. And I'd grown up then, you know. And your father's got you a job at the Langford Border Works. Well, those sort of jobs...
The water works.
Yes, at Langford.
Mm.
And those sort of jobs were gilt-edged then.
Mm.
They had a pension, you were there for life.
Mm.
But the one thing I wasn't aware of, that you couldn't earn much money. They were low-paid jobs.
Mm.
But I went there, and I was put with somebody who was the mains inspector, and I didn't quite know what this was all about, but the second week I was taken out in a small van with another chap to Battlesbridge, and I didn't know, but at the time there is a tunnel under the river there at Battlesbridge, and a water main goes through it. So we went down into this tunnel and with a torch walked through checking the water main. Then we come upside and I thought, what's next? And the chap in charge said, well, he said, John here will take you. And I said, where? Back to Langford. And with that he drove off. And we had to walk back from there across the fields, the line of the main,
right,
to Langford.
Ooh.
Now, in the summer, with a companion, that was ideal.
Yeah.
And when you got back, you could go home.
Mm.
But suddenly on my own, in the middle of the winter, with mud on your feet, on your boots, that was hard work. And
it's a fair distance.
It is, but if you saw a haystack built on the line of the main, you had to report it, and the farmer, by agreement, had to move it.
Really?
And if you saw a wet patch in a field where that would be dry, you reported it, and they come out and see if there was a leak.
Mm. Mm.
And then by the time you got back, as I say, you could go home, but that's all he wanted to do.
And did you stay at Langford? Did you stay at the Waterhouse?
No, I was there for some time, but after a few months of that sort of thing and labouring outside, I asked to go inside because they had three massive steam engines in there, and that was all run by ex-Navy people, spotless inside. And an ex-chief petty officer of the Royal Navy done the maintenance. And I got speaking to him, and he said, why don't you ask the engineer in charge if you can come in here, I could do with a hand. And so I went in there on the steam engines for four years or more. And that was a nice
lovely
job.
Lovely. Yeah.
But I could see it coming to an end, steam. So I decided to leave there. One of the things was the money anyway. And went with post office telephones.
And you stayed?
And I stayed for the rest of my life with them, yes.
For you. Yeah, lovely. Let's go back again. I wonder if you've got any other thoughts and memories of pre-war times.
I can recall that in the late 30s, living on the Downs, that we had a lot of school children for the East End of London, and that was a treat for them annually to come down to the promenade at Malden. And in the early morning, you see them trooping across the Downs onto the promenade. And in the evening, they'd all be walking back to get the last train back to London. By the same route, donkeys used to be trialled from Beeley, a field in Beeley, that is, to the promenade. And after a day's work down there, amusing the children, they were taken back to Beeley for the night. And those two things I often can recall as something I saw from the yard of our house where we lived.
You mentioned going across the Downs.
Hmm?
So is that where Downs Road now is, just above there?
The Downs Road would be, they'd come across the Full Bridge and turn into where the brewery was, where the quay is now.
Yes.
And then walk through that pathway parallel with the river and eventually come to the lower Downs and across to the quay at Malden and the promenade. World War II was upon us. And I remember the Full Bridge being wired up, ready for demolition, should the invasion of German forces occur. And this was considered likely in the Malden area. At that time, the Home Guard was formed by veterans from the First World War. And they were known as the LDV, or Local Defence Volunteers. And on a more humorous note at the time, LDV became Look, Duck and Vanish.
What's our... Bruce, was there anyone you knew or any of your family who...
Yes, my father was in the Home Guard during the war. And a lot more veterans were, and these were men that at the time were doing possibly a 12-hour day in a factory and still had to go out at nights on military duties. And another thing that I recall, which must have been halfway through the war period, was... A new frigate, HMS Rock Rose, visited Malden. It got up the river as far as Stansgate. There was not enough water for it to get any further. And this was a warship adopted by the people of Malden. And the mayor was invited aboard to accept the thanks of the Royal Navy. And then I assume that the frigate went off to war. Another thing I can recall in Heybridge, Italian prisoners of war under guard marching out to field work in the local area, and they were housed in the Towers, an Italian styled mansion built by a member of the Bentall family where the Towers estate stands today.
It was a huge mansion, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was enormous.
Yes.
So obviously plenty of room for housing prisoners of war.
Yeah.
Interesting.
They never looked very threatening, and they seemed to be happy Italians, but they were prisoners of war.
Yeah.
Living on the Downs once again, one could see right across the marshes towards Bradwell, and the V1 flying bomb, which was one of the later implements that Hitler used against us during the war, known as a doodlebug, could be seen on dark nights with its rocket tail aflame coming in from the North Sea. It crossed the Essex marshes on its way to London. They never seemed as if they had enough altitude to pass over Maldon, but they did, and they were timed to reach London when the rocket motor would cut out, sending a large bomb down to Earth.
As a family, were you, or generally, were people very nervous about the doodlebugs in case they landed sooner than...
There was me and my brother in our family, and if we got up, that was because my mother said so, but my dad... carried, he just went to sleep. He went to bed and that was it. Because being an ex-World War I veteran, he's seen all that. Nothing bothered him. If that was going to be all lot, that was going to be. And that's how he looked at it.
Yeah. Was that the attitude of a lot of people?
I think it was. Mm. I think it was because most of them went over Maldon. They didn't stop it. The odd one, you'd hear the engine stopping somewhere distant, an explosion. But most of them went on to London. Now, the other thing, which takes us back before the war, was in the early 30s, the Maldon Hippodrome was the town's cinema. And today we take it for granted, or we did over the years, that it was just a few shillings to go to a cinema and anyone could go. But in those days, children had to earn the right to go. And that was to get money where you could to buy a ticket. And one of the things we could do was ask for the rabbit skin at home after we'd had a meal of a wild rabbit. They were usually sold at the door for about ninepence to a shilling and was a good meal for four people. But the skin was kept and dried out and the rabbit fur itself was worth a few pence. This was taken round to Mr. Cole's house in Wants Road, and you'd get a few pence for the rabbit skin. The other thing that he bought from children was jam jars, pound jam jars and 2 pound jam jars. And at that time, jam was a big thing with the average family. It's often passed off for a Sunday tea, when a roast tea at that time was not heard of. But bread and jam would have been tea in those days. And so we had empty jars, and they were taken round to Mr. Cole's, and you'd get a penny or tuppence, depending on the size of the jar. And so with a few pence, you had enough to get a ticket to go in the cinema on a Saturday afternoon.
And do you know what Mr. Cole's did with the dried rabbit skin?
Well, I take it he passed them on to a dealer, you know, because in those days they would have been made into gloves or possibly during the war, anything, you know. Mm. Mm. But that was a sort of junkyard, and you could go around there and sell the skins and the jars. Mm. And through the week, that was our chance to keep an eye on the rabbit skin at home or the empty jam jar. Yeah. And that's how you done it.
Yeah. That was recycling then, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. It really was.
How else did you as children get a few pennies together? Were there any other things you did to earn money?
Well, as I said, we went to the fields to do a few, like pick peas and that, a few bob. Mm. But you was a little bit older then. Mm. In the younger days, I think you might have got a few pence every Saturday evening. Everybody in Maldon seemed to go up the high street. That was open till 8 o'clock, all the shops. And families met in the street and talked. Mm. And we ended up usually in Woolworths. And I always remember there was a stand there that sold salted peanuts. And that the light over the stand made them warm. And you've got a bag of peanuts for a penny or something. And so you bought that as much as you could get for your money. Yes, during this Saturday evening sojourn, we obviously at the top of the street turned about and looked in all the shops. And we ended up at the end of the street near North Street, where we would turn for the Downs to go home. But at that point, the men who lived in the area all seemed to turn and go into the Ship and Anchor. And the women and children were left on the corner and they would sort of depart different ways to go home. But sometimes if you were lucky, you got another extra penny. to go into the sweet shop that was on the corner, run by two old ladies. And on winter nights, that frosted glass, you look through and you saw the lights and the paper chains. It was magic. You just wanted to get into this shop. And I can remember me and my brother went in there one day, one evening, and wanted a nugget and asked for a maggot, a halfpenny maggot. With the advent of World War II, a steam crane running on rail lines was put down along the length of the Malden Quay, and it was able to unload rubble from barges into lorries, which I understand was for the airfield at Bradwell. Another recollection was of mobile anti-aircraft guns and sometimes barrage balloon units on the promenade, but usually after one evening or one night they moved on. On the promenade, at the outset of war, ARP wardens and special police used to carry out exercises. And there was a situation where volunteers stepped forward to be bandaged from head to foot, and a label was tied on them denoting the injury. And then they were put onto makeshift ambulances, and they tore off to St Peter's Hospital in a hurry, like you would if you were, there was war on.
Yeah.
Now, as children, we went down there and eagerly volunteered and enjoyed being bandaged up and having labels. And then we were laid on stretchers and rushed up to St Peter's Hospital. The bandages were taken off, the label was taken off, and we were given a couple of sweets. And of course, we then ran back through the chasers, footpaths parallel to the high street in Malden, to the promenade, and willingly lay down again for another episode.
And this happened fairly regularly, did it?
No, it only happened at one time when as the war progressed, different things were put in place, and this was an early thing, you know. Mm. And I suppose a little later on, they'd got plans how to accommodate all this. Mm. These were the first sort of things when the war started.
Sort of early training.
Yes, but we had to do something, didn't we? And so they started getting organised. Mm. And that was the sort of thing they'd done. Mm.
Great fun for children.
Well, that would appear for some of us it was.
Yeah.
The shop windows in those days would have been latticed with paper tape to prevent flying glass. Eventually, when the odd bomb or landmine even dropped in the Malden district, a lot of glass was shattered from doorways and shop windows. Mm. And I can recall seeing some shops reflecting the spirit of the times with a notice in the window, more open than usual.
More open than usual. Lovely. Yep. Were you working at this time? Were you in the greengrocer's shop? Or were you still at school?
No, the war started in 1939.
Mm.
So, yeah, that would have been 43, I suppose. So I would have been at work.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm.
Mm. Yes, I would. 14. I can recall my early years in the greengrocers, possibly 14 or 15 years old, and during the war, and it was a very quiet high street. There might have been a few army trucks coming through, hardly any private cars. Buses had gas bags on top because there was no petrol. And so there were quiet days, and sometimes unusual vehicles went through. I can remember a shepherd who sat in a pony and cart with a sheepdog, and this man had two wooden legs. And I take it he came in for provisions, and he lived somewhere over on the hill at Bicknacre, and on that hill was an army searchlight and a few soldiers, and typical of the army, a urinal that was built with corrugated iron, and inside were cubicles with a passageway right the way through. Pretty crude business. Nevertheless, it's said that the shepherd went in there one night to use one of these urinals or toilets rather, and his legs were out in the passageway, and apparently a drunken soldier came through, fell over his legs, mistook them for a wheelbarrow, picked them up and threw the shepherd into the toilet. But I must say, I have got no witnesses or know if that's the truth or not.
It's a good story. Yeah. So he was a shepherd out on the hills, just outside.
Yes.
Outside Malden. Mm. Yeah.
Well, they were about. I mean, there's pictures now. Photographs of cattle going through Malden High Street, and I can faintly recall that sheep and cows coming through the street and going down Market Hill to the station, because at one end of the station near the road were cattle pens. They're not there now, but near the road where you pass that where that old engine shed was, there were cattle pens.
Really?
And people from the farms used to drive the cattle through the high street. Mm. Now, that was the early days, but that happened. Mm. That happened everywhere.
Mm. Lovely. Thank you, Bruce.